Today I was down in Santa Rosa translating for a Thai teacher who's teaching a retreat, and they needed a translator for the day. Feeling kind of blank, actually. Just having translating is sometimes takes it out of me anyway. Usually doing trying to just maintain whatever somebody has said, trying to remember what was said, and then to translate it into English, so that just feeling a bit blank. But one of the things that comes up in my mind was a bit striking to me. It was the people that were on the retreat, certainly almost all were many different, probably several different nationalities, but mostly people who were either raised in America or educated in America, and the certain difference in the perspective of what they one of the questions was around fear, and also that he had apparently yesterday he had talked about fear or previously. And most of his examples were things which were, say, external. And the question was around and even the examples were things like fear of ghosts and whatnot. He would, when he's giving examples of fear, and that the which the person was asking the question, I think it was typical of probably most people who have grown up in the West, and particularly America, that there's what's the big deal about fear of ghosts? That isn't where my fears lie. What I really fear are things around the sense basically the sense of self, when I interact with people, that there's this kind of underlying fear. Even when there's engagement in kind of desire and a sensual gratification, a lot of it isn't really out of sensuality, it's about coming from fear. And I thought that was interesting, because when he answered the question, I think he still didn't quite get the degree to which people who have a Western upbringing and education, how much their life revolves around themselves, and me and my world, and me and my perceptions, and me and my feelings, and me and my ideas and opinions, and all sort of me and mine. And how painful that is, and how fearful it makes people, and how much, and how insidious it is, and how it works into all the ways that we how we live, how we relate to each other, how we what is important to us, what's not important to us, how when we're in particularly in relationship to other people, because we're always comparing ourselves to other people. And measuring. Do I measure up? Do I not measure up? I think it's really convoluted and complicated. And I think he really quite rightly kind of nailed the nail on the head of just the sense of, well, you know, however one experiences fear, all it is just the movement of the mind. All it is another thought. All it is just another mental construction that creates a sense of juxtaposition of me against something else. So there's me against another person, me against the world around me, me against nature. That's all it is. And it's so easy to be swept up into the whole realm of my world and my feelings that we don't realize that that's all it is. And so the purpose of you know, all practice and meditation is really to start to question the underlying sort of feelings, perceptions, and to really to see that kind of universal characteristic of what we say what our experience is. Because we are continually swept up into the realm of how we perceive the world and the world around us, and how we perceive ourselves. And it has, let's say, it has no more substantiality than, you know, in the realm of ghosts or the worries of being in a you know, like living in the living in a forest monastery and then starting to worry about mountain lion attacks or bear attacks. The fear can be extraordinarily convincing. when you're sitting in the forest and, or walking in the forest, and everything is, all the different noises are then constructed back into fear of, you know, say bear attacks or mountain lion attacks, and it all seems very logical and rational. The fear is justified statistically. It's an extraordinarily minuscule chance that one will even see an animal, let alone actually be that they would be even interested to attack. I mean, but the mind creates that possibility. The mind conceives of it as a possibility. Things that we're familiar with that are you know, much more worrisome, we don't even think about. I mean, just, you know, statistically, you know, just getting into your car should be a really fearsome experience, because the number of automobile deaths and accidents that happen, mutilations, maimings, injuries that just come through an automobile, we don't even think about it, because it's ordinary to us, and so we don't really care. And the the actual numbers of people who are seriously injured and slipping in bathtubs but we don't sort of, every time we walk into the toilet or the bathroom, we don't sort of have a panic attack, even when we see a bathtub. But statistically, it's certainly more, it should be more fearsome than being in the forest. But that's the, again, our minds don't have to have, certainly don't have to rely on rationality statistically coherent evidence. All it needs is proliferation, and it can go anywhere. So that the whole realm of the sense of what we fear and what creates fear, and doesn't, that sense of our, you know, how we perceive ourselves, and even how we construct our sense of self, doesn't really have a logical coherence. And we are born into a human form that is subject to all sorts of illness and changes, maturing, aging, degenerating, and we create an identity around just having the physical form that we have, and perceive ourselves as grounded in this physical form. You know, when we think of ourselves, it's usually almost with some sort of physical form as the basis. But in reality, why would we do that? You know, the body is completely unreliable. It's subject to illness. The number of of kind of remember one time when I was in Thailand contracting some strange disease that we weren't I wasn't familiar with and nobody else was. I was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. So one of the things, and they told me what it was, and I went to the medical library to just sort of check out the symptoms. And then there was a scrub typhus, which is a strange sort of illness that has, it's like typhoid fever, but it doesn't respond with the medicine. So if you see diagnosed as typhoid fever, and you get the medicines for typhoid fever, and then it doesn't go away because it's not the right medicine. It's from a bite, a bite from a tiny little kind of mite that lives on rats that live in secondary growth forests. So it's just like how strange that it is. There's this extraordinarily specific. But anyway, I went into the library and sort of looking at things and wandering around looking for medical, and it sort of was stacks of books and aisles and aisles of medical texts. And then it sort of, it hit me, this whole huge library is all about all the kinds of diseases that the body can have. There's hundreds and thousands of books just about what can go wrong with the body. And we trust it. We look after it, we pamper it, we worry about it, we identify with it, we worry about that it's, that it's beautiful, or that it's not beautiful, or that it's healthy, or that it's not healthy, and it's never been healthy. it's never even been trustworthy right from the beginning. And then we think it's us. just the whole sense of what we go through to look after it, and all the trouble it takes to look after a human body. When you're reasonably healthy, it's already a lot of trouble to look after a human body. Having to get it up in the morning and wash it and brush its teeth, and then you have to and then start looking for food. Is that what I want to be spending all my time doing? And then you put stuff in it, and then it's not long after you put it in, it's looking for a place to get rid of it. It's just so much work. We put up with it because we think it's me. Not only we put up with it, we have a lot of attachment for it. So creating a whole that sense of what we are, and on a certain level, that's extraordinarily simple and basic compared to what we attach to and believe to be. With our minds, our minds are even more complicated, and we take that to be ourselves as well. The process is so much more sort of fundamental in a way. It's just that where we there's a sense basis, perception through eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, feeling, then the kind of the reaction to pleasant, painful, or neutral feeling, either the liking or disliking of it, the rejection of it, or the acceptance of it, the searching for the pleasant, or the shrinking away from the unpleasant, and then all the multi-layered perceptions, thoughts, views, opinions that are created around that. We take it all to be self, take it to be me. And the Buddha's teachings is really, really to help us to understand more clearly that that's not really who we are or what we are. These are natural phenomena. It isn't as if we aren't that, in terms of we're nothing. We didn't really exist anyway. That's another extreme. Turning to sort of the, well, it's all empty anyway. There's nothing there. Which is another extreme. So that the teachings of the Buddha are really to give us the tools to be attentive to the experience of ourselves and the experience of the world around us, so that we're able to not be caught in the trap of the establishing of and identifying attachment to a sense of self, or the its opposite of being rejection and annihilation of self. And that's, it's not uncaught, say, in a Buddhist monastery from time to time. You'll always have somebody writing a letter asking to come to stay and visit, or come and ordain as a Buddhist monk, because they've sort of seen the Dhamma and are totally inspired. Everything is written trying to avoid personal pronouns. It's just so convoluted and we're not able to actually sort of use the conventions of the world or the self for its purpose. The sort of shunning, pushing away, annihilating fear of self is just as much embracing itself and being trapped by self as sort of a full-blown delusion of one's sort of grandeur and importance for the functioning of the universe, which is pretty minimal. Tools and I think that's one of the beauties of the Buddha's teaching, is that the philosophy is very direct and straightforward. But what is more, maybe even in my eyes, what is more important and really revolutionary is the tools the tools of practice of virtue and training in conduct, which is harmless and has an integrity and virtue that is has a purpose. It's not sort of that if you do good, keep your nose clean, you're going to get enlightened. But that you do good and keep your nose clean because it makes you suffer less. It makes your mind much more clear and therefore useful for understanding the human condition. And similarly, the practice of meditation. It's extraordinarily essential to be cultivating states of mind that are still and clear. And a steadiness of heart that is not that grows out of tranquility and peace. But again, it's for a purpose. Those are useful for being able to see clearly and understand and not get swept up into moods or getting swept up into our likes and dislikes and being blown away by our own feelings of either aversion or fear or whatever, or other people. To live in a world where one has a recognition, a clarity of that, well, that's that person's particular aversion or particular attachment. Well, that's there. This is my reality, and this is my. This is what I'm experiencing. So that having a sense of clarity. Well, one of the examples, today when I was translating, he gave the example of one of the disciples in the Buddha's time. A woman who lived in Savatthi, and that's where Savatthi is where the Buddha spent the majority of his range retreats, about 23 or 25 of the range retreats were spent in Savatthi. So it's a large population center. She has a very large family, was an important member of the community. She looked after the Sangha once. Somebody, she was asked, how can you maintain your engagement and activity and still practice the Dhamma? What is the experience? Because the Buddha had praised her for her realization and declared her a stream enterer, a Sotapanna, and asking, and in reply to that, what she said, well, it's as if being in a room and having the windows closed, doors closed, but knowing that the wind is blowing outside, it's a stormy day, but not being affected by it. So that there's a recognition of what is happening, of what is going on around, being in a place of say a dry, safe, a warm place, rather than being out in a storm. So that that experience of Dhamma and being grounded in Dhamma gives one the opportunity to experience the world from a place of clarity and spaciousness, brightness of mind, and knowing and whether it's internal or external, it's sort of the same thing, whether there's the different moods which are bound up by worldly habits, worldly conditioning, unskillful action or mental states, and to having a place, an abiding place of clarity where one sees that and recognizes it, and it is, it's not pulling one into it, not dragging one along with it. So that, I think that's a place of refuge that we all need to be attending to. And of course that's the function of wisdom in the Buddhist, path. And it's so the function really of our keeping precepts, the practices of virtuous conduct, practice of meditation and mindfulness, and the function of wisdom is to give us an abiding place, which is a refuge, a place of relinquishment, letting go, a place of discernment, where we're not, we might be experiencing, say, a mood of fear, or a mood of desire, or a mood of anger, or, you know, whether it's stimulated from outside or not. And to be able to recognize, oh, that's suffering, that's painful. And I don't need to get caught in it. I don't need to engage in it. And the natural tendency is toward relinquishment and returning to an abiding place of stillness, of clarity. So that, and that doesn't leave one in a place of monochromatic sort of emotional inertia. There's much more opportunity for a real state of joy and well-being, because that's a natural response to feeling comfortable within ourselves, feeling at ease within ourselves, and at ease within the condition of birth and death, condition of having a physical body and having a mind that is complex. That there's that clear seeing that leads us in a place of stillness and ease. So that, now that, let's say, the tools of Buddhism, the teachings of the Buddha, the practices that we do, sort of coming back to that place of ease and clarity. I'll offer that for reflection this evening.